Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to another episode of Dispatches. Today we are broadcasting from the Dorje Kasung office at the Shambhala Center in Boulder, Colorado. And we have here with us Mr. Jeff Walcher. Jeff has been a long-time civil servant in this community. We were trying to add up the years, and we probably ended up with something like 12 or 13 years, making half of his adult life service to the Mandala. He has held a post at different times of Director of RMSC Expansion Project, Executive Director of Shambhala Mountain Center. He is now CEO of Shambhala Mountain Development. And for many years, I believe almost 10, he served in the Sakyong's Board of Director. And he is a former employee of Naropa Institute also. So Jeff, welcome to Dispatches.
Good morning, Julia.
Hola, Jeff. Jeff, how did you get involved with this mandala? Where were you? How did you get started? Were you once a student of Trungpa Rinpoche? And how did you make the connection to the Sakyong?
Well, I won't go into all that, but the first time I actually met Trungpa Rinpoche personally was at Rocky Mountain Dharma Center. I think it was in 1978, and I was at his summer intensive training seminar that he did every year up there for, I think it was 5 or 6 days in July or August. And
do you remember the topic?
It was called Warriorship in the Three Yanas. So I was 22, and I was standing on the food line outside whatever was there at that time. And he walked out of the kitchen in his khakis and kind of intently walked along the line and stopped when he got to me and just looked at me. And I felt like a window that he just looked through, except looking at all the different layers of glass as he looked, and I felt completely transparent. And that was really the essence of the interaction. And that was, he walked on, and you know, I thought about that for a long time, and basically it was sort of a moment where, for me, that was seeing his ability to see made me realize that he knew everything that I could possibly want to know as a sort of spiritual seeker. So I became a student at that point.
That was like your job interview.
Yeah, exactly.
He looked at your karmic resume and decided, okay, I'll hire this guy.
Yeah, and I moved to Boulder that fall, I think. I think I tried to go back to where I was living in the Northwest, up in Seattle area, and it was totally empty. And then the day before my birthday in October, I decided to hitchhike back to Boulder, and I was going to make it on my birthday, and ended up sleeping under a bridge on the side of the road somewhere in Idaho. And then I got here the next day. You know, in those days, it was kind of like that freewheeling youth.
So if we look, if we look back at all the posts you have held throughout the years and are still holding, and the many projects that you have in mind, in terms of your livelihood and your so-called real-world life, have you had training in business? I believe you ran some companies, didn't you?
Well, I started. I had a degree in English and religion in college. And when I came to Boulder as a student of Trungpa Rinpoche, I got a job in the finance office at Naropa Institute in spring of 1979. And there were five or six of us in that office who were in charge of, you know, everything from creating a financial aid program to registering students and running and keeping the books for Naropa. And, you know, we would sit there after a busy summer and look at each other and say, Jesus, none of us know. We have no clue what we're doing. And none of us had a financial background. None of us had a degree. And, you know, there were no computers. There was nothing. And this thing was growing really, really fast. And at some point, I think five of us went out and got masters in business following our jobs at Naropa, because we were all kind of inspired to figure out what the conventional knowledge was about these things so we could do a better job in the future. So after I got my MBA, I went to New York and worked in the venture capital industry with David Glickstein at New York Life, and then he left and I worked there running a venture capital portfolio, making investments basically in various kind of companies for 3 years. And then following that, I spent, I guess it was 10 years before I came back to Shambhala Mountain Center, starting and running two different businesses.
Your connection as a civil servant in terms of really holding significant positions and you know, executive directorships and so on, have been under the administration of the Sakyong. How did you meet the Sakyong, and what was your connection with him originally, and how did you form the kind of relationship that allowed you to understand his vision and be willing to go through the difficulties and through the joys of bringing it forth?
Well, of course, I had known the Sakyong, like so many other people, peripherally during his younger years. And then when the first startup that I did, I actually took me to Halifax in 1988. And Sakyong and I had several kind of social interactions that went kind of way beyond social. And I would say that we had a really natural connection. You know, he's very easy to connect with personally. But I think it was, in a sense, it wasn't so much, it wasn't only that we connected, but it was also that I always thought from the time I worked at Naropa in the 70s that I would come back and do something for the mandala. That was always in my heart. Throughout my kind of venture entrepreneurial career, I was trying to make money and do all those things, but I was also kind of gathering skills and experience and working extremely hard. And somehow I look back at the time with Trungpa Rinpoche and then the fact that he passed on, and then the Vajra Regent, who I was also very close to, and his death. And when it came to sort of that time, like 1991, the Shambhala Mandala was, you know, pretty weakened. And at the time that Sakyong Mipham was asked to lead the whole mandala and take sort of his father's throne at that point. And I had just seen a lot of, I had experienced a lot of sitting back and watching what happened. And I decided that, you know, life was short and I had to do something myself. And I was sort of, in the past, I kind of waited, like someone was going to call me up one day and say, Jeff, we really want you to do this important thing for us. And so when it was the Sakyong, which was kind of for me the third time, I decided to just step in and offer to help. So I started doing that, and that's how I, shortly after that was asked to be on the board because of my financial background, primarily my business background.
On the board of directors.
Of Shambhala International in 1991.
And how did you go from there to your first mission at that time, Rocky Mountain Shambhala Center? How did you end up in Colorado doing, and what was your mission as such? What were you asked to do?
Well, I mean, obviously we in this room at least know well that Shambhala Mountain Center had been one of Trungpa Rinpoche's primary visions in terms of something he really wanted the Sangha to accomplish. And
he had wanted a Vipassana center, or do you know what it was that he had wanted? Have you looked into that?
There were lots of different things that I heard and read. You have a Vipassana center, a monastery. The Karmapa said he wanted a monastery there. There was, at one point, Trungpa Rinpoche asked us to build a Catholic monastery. He didn't say where, but I assume it might have been there as well. So it's pretty wide-ranging. And being on the board of Shambhala International, I had been, you know, privy to the kind of struggle to get this project off the ground over the early and middle years of the 90s. And really the way it happened was a group of us were sitting in a room trying to figure out who we could possibly get to follow in Dan Hesse's footsteps, who had done a great job of laying a lot of the ground for the construction and expansion. And then we also had the fact that the stupa was kind of, you know, Bob and Lindy and Joshua and all the people working on the stupa were working really, really hard in spite of incredible context within, you know, the world to build. And build this incredible monument and legacy to Trungpa Rinpoche, and also sort of this thing that sort of a stake in the ground for Dharma in the West. And by 1998, they had already been at it for over 10 years. So it was kind of like, we really need to do something. And so somehow out of that conversation, when we looked around the room, I was sort of seemingly the most likely candidate.
The one that pulled the short stick.
Yeah, exactly. So,
did you receive specific instructions or orders from the Sakyo as to what he wanted in terms of specifics? Did he want buildings? Did he want programs?
Well, of course. You know, there really was for me, a real critical turning point, which is earlier. The Sakyan gave a really amazing talk to the board of directors. I think it was in 1996. And it was a talk where, you know, at that time particularly, his kind of wrathfulness did not appear very often. But he was sitting there saying again, not for the first time, that the Shambhala Mountain, what was Rocky Mountain Shambhala Center project, was absolutely critical for the development of his vision of how to fulfill his father's vision, and that the Sangha needed a kind of monumental project to be kind of a launching off point for creating a kingdom. And the members of the board, you know, were listening to this and kind of going, well, basically saying no. And, you know, we don't, you know, all of their doubts and fears, we don't have the money, number one, we don't know what would we do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And Sakyong listened to all that, and then at some point he finally said, when you're talking to your grandchildren and they ask you what you did when you were on the board of directors of Shambhala, are you going to tell them that you said no? And he said, you know, if you say no to this, I'll just give you something else to do. And then if you say no to that, I'll give you something else to do. And if you say no to that, I'll just get a new board of directors. So are you just going to tell your grandchildren that you just said no three times, something like that? And it was an intense moment. And I've used that, the transcript I have of that talk, that was kind of my, you were talking about a seed syllable earlier before we started. And I sort of experienced that. I saw that as kind of a complete unification of, you know, kind of the Father and the Son and the mission of our kingdom to do this thing. So, you know, you ask, what is it? So there's a lot of context for saying yes, which is kind of what I think we decided to do at that point. What was it that the Sakyong wanted us to do that he saw that was so important? You know, I think it's fundamentally to create a place that, an environment where basic goodness is built into the actual place, into the structure of the place, in such a way that when people come there, they immediately know what Shambhala is on some level, even if they don't talk to anybody. And it's a place that is sort of a big umbrella or tent, as we've called it in some of the planning sessions that we did. So under that tent fits a lot of things, kind of the way you were talking about the vision of this dispatch program or the Chronicles Project, that you see so many people in the world, many of them from our Sangha, trying to benefit, whether it's working for another Dharma teacher or working for, as in the civil service, as you call it, or teaching, working in some other capacity in non-profit world or for-profit world. And the idea of Shambhala Mountain Center was that we could offer tools and support for people really trying to do that good service in the world. And in that sense, Shambhala Mountain Center is sort of this microcosm of the vision of Shambhala. What is it ultimately? What does it really mean if we had a kingdom called Shambhala? So it's a place that basic goodness is completely evident in all of the aspects of the society. And the nice thing about Shambhala Mountain, I think, is that we own the property. And that's fairly easy to do. You can own a few hundred acres. And within that, as long as you follow, you know, more or less the laws of the country that you live in, you can do what you want. And in our case, it became a great laboratory experiment for what could this kingdom be.
For those who have never been there, who have never seen them, or who haven't been there for a very long time, can you describe what is on the land these days?
Well, I like to ask people to support Shambhala Mountain Center financially. And often I sort of try to define it in terms of thinking, like, if you paid for the construction or support or maintenance of a square foot of the property or of a building, I mean, what's really in a square foot of that place? So I'm going to start kind of at this little tiny, because I think it is where the essence of it is. And the thing is what is so amazing about each of those square feet is the intention of everyone who participates in either building it or coming to a program there or staffing a program, teaching. And the point is that, you know, it's human intention that I think is what gives things power, especially things that we build or spaces that we create. And we like to talk about containers for things. And we know in Shambhala that we have great expertise in putting on events. Why is that? Why are the events we put on so powerful? Because it's because we create these containers, spaces, in which something can happen, in which people who are coming together with a certain kind of intention can be supported in a way that allows that intention to really manifest in their activity, whether it's practice or socializing or cleaning up, whatever. So the thing that's so special about every square foot of Shambhala Mountain Center is that the intention of the people that built it and run it and come there is so connected to the kind of deepest parts of their own hearts and their vision that they hold in their minds for making the world a better place, for becoming enlightened in this life. Those kinds of qualities. So, you know, people always go to the Great Stupa, which is our most important facility. You were asking about them. So this is a facility, a building, basically. It's just a piece of concrete that took 17 years to build. And if you think about, for me at least, what makes it so powerful? Why is it that some guy can get off a Harley and walk up to the Great Stupa and just be completely stunned? Even if they never heard of Trungpa Rinpoche or Sakyong Mipham or the Kagyu lineage or Buddhism or anything, I believe it has to do with the intention that went into creating that space, that structure, that thousands of people over many, many years constantly put their good intention into that. This building, you know, whether you look at it as the structure that contains the relics of your guru, or you look at it as a monument for peace, a symbol, whatever, all of those intentions that those people had, whether they were sticking a, you know, sawing off a, or sanding down a piece of rough concrete, or filling a little hole with a, you know, a plug of plaster, painting something, making a statue or a painting, leaving a dollar bill in a box, offering a stick of incense, all of that activity over, now it's like almost 20 years, is all about those good things. And so that empowers a place. And in the case of Shambhala Mountain, it's been incredibly blessed by that intention, from the greatest teachers in the world to civil servants like me.
And you also have a sacred studies hall and a lodge. And
so during the time I was there, we finished the Great Stupa, of course, and we built, we transformed what I call a Buddhist summer camp into a year-round kind of conference and retreat facility that now has indoor housing for about 150 people year-round, two lodges with about 100 bedrooms, and the Sacred Studies Hall, which is our primary program space, the Children's Center, and then we also purchased and winterized and renovated the Red Feather Conference Center, which used to be owned by the Campfire Council. So it's a total of about 50,000 square feet of new and renovated program, dining, and housing space.
It's exquisitely designed, and the materials are very, very, very fine quality. Who were your aesthetic and architectural masters?
Well, there's kind of a lineage there. Many people have been involved with that. Richard Rice here in Boulder was a project architect for many years during the time of all this construction. Sherry Fultonier and Hank Risen from Boston were involved, and Sherry's still deeply involved with the master plan from the, especially and also landscape architecture. A local architect here in Boulder, Jim Logan, has designed the two lodges and is currently working with us on a plan for some staff housing. And another local Sangha person, Catherine Ron, designed the Children's Center. Bob Rader is our master interior designer, and he's been involved with all of the buildings that I've built. I'm sure I'm leaving out someone. Did I mention Eva Wong? Eva's been closely involved for a number of years and is helping to design the vision for the next buildings that we built. And, of course, Jim Tolstrup, who devoted himself for, I think, 5 years to the ecological stewardship and land stewardship of the center, which really was something that was so long overdue and has made a huge difference in the beauty and sustainability of the center. And I also should mention especially Ben Pressman, who in the early years was the construction manager who really personally built with his own body and mind many of the buildings that we talked about. And last and not least, the Kings and Joshua Mulder and Greg Smith up at the Great Stupa. It's been a real group process. And, we had tremendous support from the board of Shambhala Mountain. Karen Wilding is the chair. And then also from some of our legacy partners like Dan Hesse, who's been involved with Shambhala Mountain for many, many, many years and has been a real close partner and advisor. And recently joined the board.
And then in the summer, you add on the visualization of the summer camp, and you add how many more living spaces and how many more dining spaces. And
yeah, we have, I think there's 250 tents roughly, but in our maximum capacity in the summer is 530 people. And, there are times when we run it completely at capacity. And we add a dining tent and a big program tent, which is sort of the great tradition that was there when I first went in 1978 and told the story about meeting Trungpa Rinpoche. It was, from back in the day, as we say. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was in 1985 that he moved the Vajradhatu Seminary to Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, as it was in that day, moved out of the hotel rental business and said, we really need to create our own place. And again, I connect that back to this idea of intention, creating power. And he said at that time, if we keep going to these hotels, we just go in with our little banners
portable
and shrines and whatnot, and that's very sweet, but we're not actually accumulating any drala or power in our sort of container. We just go, we set it up, and we leave. And it would be so much more powerful for the long term if we did it on our own space and our own land.
And talking about the long term and talking about intention, one of the things that occurs when you create something is that then you have to feed it. How do we feed and care for the debt? And what do we actually put inside this container in terms of the programs? And how do we maintain the contemplative atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's well said. Obviously, and this is, you know, this is where the rubber on the road meet in terms of saying that we want to create a place that's a laboratory for Shambhala Kingdom. We have to do all those things, and it's not easy. And I found, you know, myself struggling to, you know, continue the business side and develop the business, which I developed tremendously during that time, and we basically, you know, quadrupled the program revenue, if you want to look at it from that point of view, which means that hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people were participating in programs at Shambhala Mountain, taking advantage of the teachings that we had to offer each year. You know, it was just so much more than we had ever been able to do before. And then in that context, to do that, how do you do that from a professional point of view? How do you staff that? And then how do you manage the center and care for all the facilities, cook all the meals, clean all the dishes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and maintain, you know, really with a group of people who are basically donors or patrons or volunteers in terms of if you look at what they're getting paid to be there, and many of whom are very young in terms of their own practice and are coming there, as they always do, to Shambhala residential centers, primarily to learn, rather than to, you know, at least for the younger people, rather than to offer service like some of us who are older are not so concerned about our own practice as we are about creating that space for the next group of people to experience. So it's a huge issue. And this is really the key, is how do you mix those things together? And you know, I think that the new director, Alan Cross, is doing a great job in trying to find a balance. During the time I was there, it was a huge entrepreneurial express train. And in order to build, we had to generate the revenue. In order to generate the revenue, we had to grow the programs. The programs are still growing now, but there is much more of a focus on how do we find a balance.
How to create the community aspect, the contemplative community within that.
Exactly. And it's a very tricky thing.
The mojo.
It's not done. I mean, there's not really any examples for it. You can't go down to Microsoft or down to really any other nonprofit. And when you look at the other, you know, the other sort of outside of the Shambhala world, if you look at like Kripalu Yoga Center or Esalen or Spirit Rock, which are some of the ones that we typically think of, Omega, they're not doing what we're talking about in that way.
And how is it different?
Well, I'm just saying, like, for example, Kripalu, I know pretty well. That used to be an ashram. And they had a community, and then they had a major break between themselves and the original founder. And they almost went bankrupt. And then they kind of, a lot of the people who were their core constituency got together and said, wow, we have to save this
structure.
This thing. And so it became a business. And then they still try to balance somehow. But they're in a town, and they have hundreds of employees, and they put on hundreds of programs, and it's changed its character tremendously. And I don't know exactly what they're doing these days. I wouldn't want to say, but you know, they're not able to have that kind of laboratory the way I was talking about and have it be successful.
So we're definitely not moving towards a conference center, disembodied conference center with a staff. It's just you're taking the challenge to be more inclusive and have the right facilities, but still having to figure out how that facilities are actually inhabited by the lineage.
Yeah, I mean, I never saw it any other way than that. You know, I think that our community needs to send some of our kids to hotel management school. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a serious thing we're trying to do from that point of view. It's not like Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, where in the wintertime you can just hunker down and, you know, survive and practice. This is a place that needs to run 52 weeks a year, and not only from a business point of view, but from its mission point of view. And as
what
far
is
as,
its mission?
Well, I think it's to provide a place and programming that supports the thousands of people, millions of people in our country, in our world, who are trying to make the world a better place, to bring that intention of goodness to their lives, to themselves, to their families, to their communities.
But wouldn't the real challenge be how to have that message be given by the staff, not just in the professionalism of their service, but by the profundity of their practice?
I think so. I mean, I think, and that's why I say again, it's like not just hiring someone who's gone to hotel management school, but actually sending, a Dharma brat there, or someone who's really connected to the vision. Because we need to combine the expertise of the conventional world with the brilliance of, the Shambhala vision. And that is at an individual level. And, I would say that I hear sometimes that, when you mention the word daring, I don't see this as daring. When people come to visit Shambhala Mountain Center, there was one program in particular I'm thinking of. It was a group of ladies, mostly, I think, from a salon in Fort Collins and Boulder in Denver. It's a salon called The Parlor. And they came and did a retreat there, and or a meeting, whatever it was. And people were saying, oh my God, that's so horrible, that, you know, these are just like haircutting people, whatever you call them, hairstylists coming to do a weekend corporate business retreat. What? That's terrible. That's like watered down Trungpa Rinpoche's vision. And I see it completely the opposite. I thought that what he wanted to do, and I see clearly what the Sakyong wants to do, is to penetrate and get inside of the rest of the world. The vision of meditation, of the essential qualities of the Ashe or any of these things, these are not things that can be watered down by having people come and visit. What happens is actually they experience, thanks to the intention of all the people I talked about, and what kind of the brilliant place that's been created there, people come there, it doesn't matter who they are, they're getting touched by it. They're not watering it down. They just come and take something and leave. They don't come and paint it a different color and then it's no longer powerful. This is like a tremendous reservoir of drawla and power at this place. All we have to do is open the door wider and we can actually share it and communicate it to others. So,
well, you know how do means way. Maybe this is the beginning of do-do.
Do-do, right.
It all started at Shambhala Mountain Center.
Yeah.
The first thought of the hair do-do.
Again, I'm not saying that that means that, I'm not saying that there's no maintenance that has to happen, not only on the staff point of view, not only in terms of the teachings and the authenticity of the people and their practice, but also in terms of the traditional practices, the lineage practices that we have. We have some retreat cabins there. We have, and I think it's really important that people do solitary retreat there, and the cabins are placed like right way up at the top of behind Marpa Point, where the energy, from a feng shui point of view, where the energy is kind of like pouring out of the mountain.
The kami.
And the kami shrine is taken care of, and then the stupa. And I know for myself, in all the years that I was there, practicing in the stupa was really the most important single thing that I did. And we have to also do, and we always have done, a lot of that kind of practice, a more core or advanced or Vajrayana practice at Shambhala Mountain Center. Shambhala Mountain Center is the place, I think, in our mandala of all of our places where you can take a leap from whatever level you are to another level in terms of the profundity of your experience. That's what it's for. So whether it's a gateway for someone from a hair salon to, for 1 second, to connect to their deepest kind of essential point, or whether it's a place for, Lopan or Larry Mermelstein to come and teach people the Chakrasanvara Sadhana. That's what it is. It's a place to take the next leap, and It's not soft. It's very kind of intense. It's the Rocky Mountains, and it's very changing and very uncertain. And it's that kind of environment that lends itself to really fulfilling the vision that the Sakyong commanded us to do.
Yeah, maybe it's that notion that at any point in one's practice, one must always remember Zen mind, beginner's mind. It's the moment of freshness, and that is the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You are, you're basically retired. What's this new phase like for you right now?
Well, I'm having a really good time in a lot of ways because thanks to Alan and Doria taking on the role of executive director and protectress, as she's called, I have been able to really step back from any kind of day-to-day responsibility at Shambhala Mountain, although this year I'm still deeply involved with the fundraising aspect. And I am very inspired to sort of take a next step, and in conversations with Sakyong Mipham, we have established a new foundation that I'm going to be developing over the next few years. It's called the Sakyong Foundation. And the inspiration for it, for me, is really just playing on, I guess, what turned out to be my greatest strength in terms of building Shambhala Mountain Center and such, which is relating to the financial aspect of things. And, of course, for all of us who are involved with trying to fulfill the vision of Shambhala in whatever way we are, the financial limitations of that are, a great constraint and always have been. And again, there was a place where Shambhala Mountain, thanks to the generosity of the Shambhala Trust back in 1997, 98, 99, was able to launch a great campaign. And I didn't really address the financial issues you raised, but during that time, we raised about $12 million in donations and borrowed about $5 million to build all the things that we talked about and develop all the programming that we've developed. And because of the expanded kind of quality of the vision that we were developing at Shambhala Mountain, we were able to touch a lot of people who were kind of beyond our close family of longtime patrons. And so what I want to do going forward is try to develop an endowment within the context of the Sakyong Foundation that will help support the crosses and the costs of running Shambhala Mountain going forward, and also the Sakyong's growing family and the other initiatives that he is involved with kind of on a global basis, whether it's in Halifax or Tibet. So that's kind of the inspiration behind the Sakyong Foundation and where I'm going to be putting a significant amount of my energy, I hope, for the next few years.
Just to close, Jeff, what will be your sort of heart's wish in terms of having people contribute to your new vision and or having people contribute to what was already created at Shambhala Mountain Center?
Well, I think that Shambhala Mountain Center, again, is an example. The idea behind it was that it would really transform or could become a source of transformation and further fulfillment for the peoples of Shambhala. So I guess my aspiration is that people try to discover what that is, and whether that means coming to Shambhala Mountain Center for the first time or coming back after many years being away and being able to connect with the best of themselves and the best of what Shambhala Mountain has to offer, and that people will continue to join as staff, as teachers, and as supporters in whatever way they can. And then as far as the Sakyong Foundation goes, well, we'll talk more about that in the future, I hope. But again, I hope that the foundation will become a resource that can help to bring a sense of enrichment and give people support for the many, many great things that they're dreaming of doing.
Out of curiosity, what are your refuge and bodhisattva names?
My refuge name is Moon of Patience, and my Bodhisattva name is Wisdom Ship.
Well, let's hope that with the light of the Moon of Patience, you can actually move the ship forward and deliver Shambhala to wondrous other shores. So thank you for all your work, for all your effort, for all your dedication, for all your patience, for all your exertion, and for creating such a beautiful ground for us to enjoy. Thank you, Jeff.
Shambhala.